Hi, I'm Anna Soper, and I'm a visual artist and librarian in Kingston, Ontario, Canada. This is Teen People, the podcast where I track down people who were in Teen People magazine and find out how life's going now. Teen People was a spin-off of People and was published between 1998 and 2006. In the year 2000, Teen People's then-publisher Anne Zarin said presciently, "We make celebrities real, and real teens celebrities." To that end, Teen People scouted real teens to model clothes and makeup. They mentored high school journalists and cultivated a core of thousands of readers they called trend spotters, who responded to Teen People's calls for submissions, which were often, to be frank, thinly veiled marketing exercises. Teen People printed their young content creators' full names, ages, and locations, which makes this podcast possible since I use my library science skills to track them down online. Where are they now? Join me as we stroll down memory lane and revisit my guests' formative years. In this episode, I was privileged to interview Dave Karger, the award-winning TV host, interviewer, journalist, and film expert. He is a host on Turner Classic Movies, TCM, and has been the Oscars expert on NBC's Today since 2000. He also spent over 15 years writing about the Oscars for Entertainment Weekly and has co-hosted ABC's Live from the Red Carpet pre-show. He's also served as the Academy's official red carpet greeter on Oscar night. This means he's well qualified to have written a book about the Oscars. His new book, 50 Oscar Nights, takes an exclusive look behind the scenes of the Academy Awards. Featuring Dave's original interviews with 50 Hollywood figures, this revealing portrait of Oscars history is the perfect gift for cinephiles. So why is Dave Karger on my podcast? Well, turns out he freelanced for Teen People magazine in the early years of his career. He appears in one of the Teen Peoples that I still have in my collection. He wrote a story on LFO, which arrived in my mailbox in April of 2001. If you watch TCM like I do, you've probably seen Dave's musical matinee promo, where he speaks about his childhood piano lessons and how that sparked an interest in musical theater and the performing arts. So I asked him what inspired his career in entertainment journalism.
I knew I wanted to do something involved with the entertainment industry. I just wasn't sure what. I wrote for my high school newspaper. I was the film critic for my college newspaper at Duke University, and I did a couple of other journalistic pursuits. I wasn't really sure what I was going to do. Every summer in college, I would come home to New York and do a different internship. I interned at a PR firm. I interned at MTV, and I liked both, but it wasn't perfect. It wasn't the perfect fit. And then after my junior year, I got an internship at Entertainment Weekly magazine. And I had been a charter subscriber for the 4 years that the magazine had been in existence at that point. This was in 1994. And I went there for the summer, and that was kind of my aha moment where I realized this is a place that I belong. My writing style was very much in line with the vibe of Entertainment Weekly. I liked the people a lot. So I got hired there as an assistant, answering phones and writing little short articles right after I graduated college in 1995. And I worked my way up essentially from intern to assistant all the way up to senior writer. And I stayed there for 17 years.
Wow. And what led you to Teen People magazine? Because I have one of my Teen Peoples right here that you are in.
Oh my gosh. Now, is that the one with the story on LFO?
It certainly is.
Okay, so here's what happened. So I was a young writer at Entertainment Weekly. I was 27 years old at the time. This was in the year 2000. And I had two main beats, if you will, in my job at EW. I was covering the Oscars and all of the kind of Oscar season movies. And I also was covering pop music because from a very young age, as you've heard me say on TCM, I loved music. I had a little record player. I collected 45s. And then I was collecting cassette tapes and making mixtapes. I was music obsessed, MTV obsessed when it first launched. And I don't say this as a diss on anybody, but the people who worked at Entertainment Weekly, who were in the music section of the magazine, they were a little snobby about pop music and teen pop music in particular. And this was the time of Britney, Backstreet Boys, NSYNC. I, on the other hand, loved all that. And I made that known. They knew that that guy who wrote about the Oscars also liked pop music. So they would come to me and they would say, "We're doing a big story on this new girl, Britney Spears. You're going to do it." And I said, "Great." So I got to do our first cover story on Britney and first cover story on the Backstreet Boys. That was in 1998. That was my very first cover story for the magazine. I was 25 years old, very excited to have a cover story. And around that time, in my travels in the kind of pop music world, I met Lori Majewski, who I'm sure you know was one of the founding editors of Teen People. I really hit it off with her. And when she needed, I guess, a freelance journalist to write some big articles for Teen People, she contacted me. And the first one I think I did was on NSYNC, and it was a cover story on NSYNC. And then the second story I did, I believe, was that LFO story. And it's funny because Lori was my editor, and I was still on staff at Entertainment Weekly. But since EW and Teen People were sister magazines, it was okay for me to do it. And then a couple of years later, Lori ended up coming to Entertainment Weekly as our music editor. And I wrote for her again, but at EW. So I've had this kind of interesting history with her. I don't know if you've come across her yet in your podcast, but she's just a wonderful person.
She and I are following each other on Instagram, and I interviewed Zena Burns in 2020, who I'm sure you know as well.
Yes, I know the name. And Jeremy Heliger is another editor who I dealt with, I think, at Teen People.
Oh,
Unless
okay.
I'm getting him confused with someone else at a, maybe he was just at regular people. But anyway.
Could have been. I have an excerpt from this LFO article.
Oh gosh, let's hear it.
Okay, so it turns out that Rich Cronin was unwell when you met them. You wrote, "Rich Cronin is ill, slouched on a sofa in a New York City recording studio, wearing jeans and a ski cap that covers his usually well-kempt blonde hair. The LFO singer-songwriter appears to be nursing a monster case of the flu. We did a radio show last night in Buffalo," he mumbles. "I threw up before the show. Please tell me you did not catch his flu."
I did not. And now to hear you say that, it's breaking my heart because I'm so young, Rich Cronin, the lead singer of LFO. He was only in his 30s. I'm not saying this was related. This was years before. He just had the flu. But just to know now everything that band, I mean, they just went through so three of the four members of that band are deceased. It's so awful. And what promise they had. And I remember that album that I interviewed them for. They were so excited about it. It didn't really end up making any impact like their first album did. It was so much better than their first album, as I remember. Again, this is 23 years ago. This is like ancient history to me, but I still haven't thought about it. But yeah, it's such a tragic story, that band.
Was there anything else about working for Teen People that stands out to you all these years later?
I just really appreciated getting to do it because I think exposed my writing to a much different generation. I'm sure there were young people reading Entertainment Weekly, but not in the numbers that at Teen People. And it was fun to just write a little differently. I mean, my writing wasn't that different from the Entertainment Weekly stuff to the Teen People stuff, but I definitely wrote it with knowing that it was going to be younger people reading it. And I was young myself. I was 27 years old at the time. I wasn't some old guy like I am now. So it was a fun challenge. It was the heyday of that teen pop music. So it was exciting to be writing for a magazine like Teen People at that time.
I bet. Yes, it was before, the end of print, quote unquote. Maybe that's why you're
Yeah.
on TV now.
Listen. The writing was on the wall in 2012 when I left Entertainment Weekly. I knew that print journalism was declining, and I had aspirations to do something different. And I loved the 17, 18 years that I spent at Entertainment Weekly. I got to travel the world. I got to interview everybody in the music world and the movie world. And even in this book that I have out now, so many of the people that I interview in the book were people who I initially interviewed as a writer at Entertainment Weekly. So for all these years later to come back to them was really fun.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your writing style a few minutes ago, and that's something that I've noticed looking at this Teen People article. It's very, I think a lot of people are sort of dismissive of teen magazine writing and, you know, writing content for teens, but your writing style is as professional as anything you would find in Entertainment Weekly or anything you'd find in Rolling Stone, because that was the level on which you were working. And I love that you brought that spirit to Teen People magazine, that you weren't looking down on this audience, you know, the readers of my age who were reading this content.
That's really nice of you to say. I really appreciate that. I never wanted to pander to any audience I was writing for, especially the young audience of Teen People. And I've always been the kind of person who enjoys writing about other people. There are some journalists who insert themselves much more into the proceedings, and I said this and I did that. That's never been my style. I really like kind of having the spotlight on other people when I'm writing. So adding the details, that to me is what makes an article interesting and fun. So I liked paying attention to what people did and said, and I never wanted to knock them down. I wanted to make them look good. But if I could have a little bit of fun with them, I definitely tried to do that whenever I could.
Yeah. What was it like interviewing Britney Spears?
Well, she was 16 years old at the time. I think I've only ever seen her one time since. Like, I think I ran into her like a year later, but I have not kept up with her at all. It was really interesting. I think back on that experience now. She had the number one album and song at the time, Baby One More Time. She was doing all these appearances on TRL and Rosie O'Donnell. And then we had lunch, and we were in New York City. And I remember, I'll never forget, I said to her people, I said, tell Britney that she should decide where we're going to go to lunch, which restaurant. So she picked this place that I think is still around in Times Square called Virgil's Barbecue. And it's, let's just say, it's not light food. And she ate like ribs and mashed potatoes and like hush puppies. And I loved this girl. I loved that she was 16 wanting to eat whatever she wanted. But I definitely sensed a naivete with her. I remember, I'll never forget, even though this is 25 years ago, at one point she had a manager who had come on new to her team. And I remember saying to her, well, you have Johnny as your manager, but you also have Larry, and Johnny's just come on. Like, how does it work? Like, who does what? And I remember her answer. She said, well, Johnny's my manager and Larry's my co-manager. Or maybe it's the other way around, I'm not sure. And I was really struck by that. I mean, she was 16. And she, even though she was the number one artist in the country, she was still a 16-year-old girl. And there were many parts of the interview that really reminded me of that, and that I tried to get across in the interview, in the article.
Wow, that's very powerful. I interviewed a journalist recently for this podcast, and she's just written a book called Toxic, and it features a chapter on Britney Spears. And one of the things that she shared was that her observations at a distance of Britney Spears, she's never met Britney Spears, but her observations are that at the time, Britney was not adequately protected by the people around her. And that probably led to some of the more intrusive questions that journalists did ask of Britney Spears.
Maybe. Yeah, I definitely interacted with her. I get the sense that it was before any of that. I get the sense that when my world collided with hers, it was during a much more innocent time.
Yeah.
And there, and just one last thing, I remember we were leaving the Rosie O'Donnell show. That's where I met her. And then I was told to get in her SUV as she was being driven away. And that's where we met before the interview. And there was a kind of a crazed, if you will, fan, older gentleman waiting outside saying, Britney, I have nothing without you. Sign this for me. And he was kind of chasing her down the street. And I remember she turned to her kind of chaperone at the time, and she said, what's wrong with him? And there was just this innocence to her. She was seeing everything. She was seeing crazy fandom for the first time right then, one guy. And I think about everything that she must have experienced in the 10 subsequent years. It must have just blown her mind. But that was again, 25 years later, something I will not forget.
Wow. Wow. Well, let's shift over to talking about your book, because your publisher sent me a copy of this beautiful book, and I've really enjoyed reading through it. And I thought that one of its most unique features is that you've taken the interviews you did with the stars, and you've written them in the first person. So to me, it felt like Nicole Kidman was telling me about her Oscar night.
Thank you. And I know that you are very literate, so that coming from you means a lot to me. Yes. So this book, 50 Oscar Nights, contains all new interviews that I did just for this book with 50 Academy Award winners, from Nicole Kidman and Julia Roberts and Meryl Streep to Elton John and John Legend, and people from the 60s and 70s who won, like Mel Brooks and Rita Moreno as well. And it was so much fun to put together. And from the outset, I did know that that's how I wanted to format it. I wanted each chapter, which is either 4 or 6 pages long, to begin with a short, quite frankly, Entertainment Weekly style introduction, where I basically tee up the interview. But I wanted the meat of each interview chapter to be the person's answers in first person. And I'm really glad that I did it that way, because I think it does have an intimacy to it, it that makes you do feel like you're hearing from these people and not me. So my job is to tell you what you need to know at the beginning, give a couple facts, and then let the winner tell you their story.
Mm-hmm. I thought also starting us off with Nicole Kidman was a really powerful chapter, because she described winning the Oscar, having very mixed feelings, going to the, I think it was the governor's ball afterwards, and feeling slightly embarrassed to walk in there with her Oscar. And then, although she had family around her and had that love and support, she says that she went to bed alone before midnight. And as she was lying there, she thought, I need to find love. And I just thought, wow, that's a really, really powerful way to start off this book, with somebody who looks back on such a glittery evening with such strongly mixed feelings.
Well, I love interviewing her. I've interviewed her many times over the years. She was one of the people that I reached out to at the beginning of this whole process. And she was one of the first to say yes, which was very helpful, because then when I was reaching out to everybody else, I could say, I have Nicole Kidman on board already. Now, don't you want to be in this book? And that helped. But I knew she was going to be very sensitive, very candid, and she was everything I hoped she would be. And people have asked me how I ordered the chapters in the book. I don't do it alphabetically. I don't do it chronologically. I basically alternate male and female, because there's 25 of each in the book. But I knew I wanted the book to start with 4 really big names who also had interesting stories to tell. So I know it starts with Nicole Kidman and then Elton John. And then I think Jennifer Hudson and Steven Spielberg, those are the first 4. So I knew I wanted, you know, a couple actors, a singer, and a filmmaker to kick it off in big fashion. And she was the perfect person to start it off with.
And it ends with Meryl Streep, of course.
How can it not? I mean, the book is called 50 Oscar Nights. She's the most nominated actor ever by a long shot.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that she agreed to do it.
Of all the stars that you interviewed for this book, is there a story of someone's Oscar night that particularly stands out to you?
I loved Jane Fonda's Oscar night, because it was also so filled with mixed emotions, kind of like Nicole Kidman. I mean, she was so excited to win her first Oscar for Clute in the early 70s. But at the same time, her political activism had caused so much hostility towards her in the Hollywood community and the world at large. So she wasn't sure if they were going to boo her if she won. She was very worried that they were going to. Well, they didn't. She thought about maybe saying something political in her speech, but her father, Henry Fonda, cautioned her against that, so she listened to him. And then when she finally finished her speech, she was so relieved that they didn't boo her, and then she started feeling guilty that she had an Oscar when her dad, Henry Fonda, did not. So she got kind of emotional and broke down backstage afterwards. So I just really appreciated, first of all, I was astonished at her recall over 50 years later of all of these different emotions and things that she was going through. And then I just appreciated that she was willing to share all that with me for this book, because I think it will open a lot of people's eyes to what it must be like to go through such an intense experience like that, where the eyes of the world are on you. I just loved her interview. It was special.
I'm just going to look this up. I just want to see if there's anything that jumps out at me.
Sure.
Yeah, so you excerpt a part of each Oscar winner's speech at the top of the chapter. So she says, "There's a great deal to say, and I'm not going to say it tonight."
That's what her dad told her to do. And she listened to him. It's a rare moment of Jane Fonda holding her tongue in a situation where she could be eloquently political. But I don't think she regrets it. I think she realizes that was the right move at the time.
And we know that she and her father had had difficulties in their relationship over the years. So I think that's I keep coming back to that word powerful, but it's really powerful that she that she listened to him and took that advice to heart.
Yeah, she was great. I so enjoyed talking to her.
In the spirit of your day job on TCM, is there an old Hollywood star, someone who's not with us now, that you would have loved to have featured in this book?
I'm fascinated by the story of Hattie McDaniel, who, of course, won Best Supporting Actress in 1940 for Gone with the Wind. But because the Oscars were being held in a hotel, the Ambassador at that time, that did not allow people of color inside the walls, they made an exception for her, but she had to sit in the back of the room, like off to the side, away from all the other white nominees from her movie. And then she won, and they brought her up. She gave a beautiful, beautiful speech. And I would have loved to have heard from her firsthand what that was like, the elation of winning, but also the indignity of the treatment. Because I just think that's a moment of history that I would have loved to have captured.
One of the first Oscars I remember seeing was the year that Halle Berry won for Monster's Ball, and you have her in your book.
Yes, and that was very special for me, just personally, because at the time that Monster's Ball was being filmed, I was a writer at Entertainment Weekly, and I was given the assignment to go down to Louisiana and watch her film the movie for 2 days and interview her in her trailer on the set of the film. And even when I was down there, all the crew was telling me, watch out for this performance. What she's doing is very, very special. I didn't know Halle Berry before that. I wasn't sure what to expect. I did not expect her to be as fascinating and thoughtful as she was. She was clearly feeling all of her creative power at the time. And we did a couple great interviews over that whole season. I wrote a cover story on her. And I was in the auditorium when she won. And it wasn't a sure thing because she had not won the Golden Globe that year. Sissy Spacek had won for In the Bedroom, but she won. And it was this, I mean, magical moment where she gave that beautiful speech. And I'll never forget, after my cover story came out on her, she sent me flowers, which very rarely happens. She sent me the most beautiful note, most beautiful flowers. But I never saw her or talked to her again until we reunited on Zoom for the interview for this book 22 years later.
Wow.
And it was so special for us to see each other again. I mean, 22 years had gone by. We couldn't believe it. And I really like her interview a lot. I think she's also very honest about the challenges she went through to get the part, to do the part, to pick the dress, and then to compose herself when she did win, to continue her career afterwards, which has, not been smooth sailing. So I really love her chapter two for so many reasons.
What are you most looking forward to at the Oscars this year?
Well, I'm looking forward to the two supporting actor and actress categories. One, because I think Robert Downey Jr. will win for Best Supporting Actor for Oppenheimer. I think he's great. He had his first Oscar nomination 30 years ago. So I think it's going to be a really terrific moment, kind of like when Jamie Lee Curtis won last year, this career capping moment for someone who everyone loves. And he's so good at giving speeches. He's so charismatic. So that. And then also, I'm a big fan of Davine Joy Randolph, the actress from The Holdovers, who's probably going to win Best Supporting Actress. She also loves TCM, by the way, just like you, Anna. And I think she'll give a great emotional speech. I think it's going to be a wonderful, beautiful, almost overwhelming moment for her.
Fantastic. Well, my last question for you is, I'm just going to drag some of my team people. So, I don't know if you ever flipped through a Teen People magazine when you were writing for Teen People, but something that they did that was sort of unique was that they featured real teenagers in every Teen People magazine, and they saw them as content creators. They provided attribution to these teens, full names, ages, locations, which means that I can come along all these years later and Google people and track them down. So you're someone who's very easy to find because you wrote for Teen People, you're a professional, you're out there. And one thing I like to do with all of my guests is ask them, what advice would you give your younger self today?
I would tell myself to just build an expertise on the topics in life that I'm fascinated with. It's kind of what I did unknowingly, but I spent so much time studying music and TV and movies and reading magazines, and just learning about it. It didn't feel like work. It didn't feel like anything that I would then use in my professional life, but it was me following my passion. And I would tell myself, keep doing that. And I tell young people when I meet them, that's what they should do. They should, whatever it is, they should develop an expertise in something, because that people will always be looking for authentic, knowledgeable voices in some topic, in some subject. So find that, identify it, and obsess about it, because I do think that will be helpful later in life.
That's such great advice. Thank you. And thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Anna. Great to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. I'm looking forward to the next time I see you on TCM, and then I can be like, oh, I interviewed Dave Karger.
I'm on tomorrow night, starting at what time zone are you on?
I'm in the Eastern time zone.
So 8 o'clock tomorrow night. I'm
8
on
o'clock
all
tomorrow
night.
night.
Sure. Yeah.
I'll be home. By the way, I saw you on Drew Barrymore's show last week. You were great.
That was so exciting. She loves TCM.
Yes.
So
And
that was a thrill.
she used to work with Robert Osborne hosting
Interesting.
Classics. Yeah,
That's right.
she's incredible. I would love to have her on my podcast someday.
Don't give up.
Thank you. I'm grateful to Dave's publisher, Running Press, for sending me a copy of 50 Oscar Nights. If you want your own copy, you can find 50 Oscar Nights online and in bookstores. It's a beautiful book full of iconic photographs and first-person stories from stars like Elton John, Martin Scorsese, Octavia Spencer, Mel Brooks, and Emma Thompson. If you liked this episode, have a listen to my previous episodes. As I mentioned in this interview, I spoke with the British journalist Sarah Dightem about her book Toxic: Women, Fame, and the Tabloid 2000s, which is published by Abrams Press. Toxic, named for the Britney Spears song, of course, examines the corrosive celebrity culture of the late 90s and early 2000s, and how it shaped the way we see ourselves, our bodies, and our lives. Here's an excerpt.
When she was being pitched around as a solo artist, there was quite a lot of skepticism about it. And the perception was that solo female artists were over. People wanted to listen to girl bands. And so Britney has to kind of overcome that perception before she is able to be launched as a solo star. That's thematically interesting, I guess, because when you look at the noughties, you're looking at a period that is just relentlessly anti-sisterhood, that just in every imaginable way, looks for ways to pitch women against women, is fascinated by every bit of trash talk that you can find from, you know, like there are lots of snippy things that I've quoted in the book that various women in the book have said about other women in the book. And the media fed off of those and loved them. But I also think it was teaching the women like us who were consuming this media a lesson, which is you don't survive by identifying with other women and like making common cause with women. You survive by being not like the other girls.
Thank you for listening to Teen People. Please connect with me on Twitter and Instagram at Teen People Pod, and help me reach more listeners by sharing my work on your socials. I'm Anna Soper. Bye for now.